Hello, Brian Dwyer with you. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio, my final program today. Oh. And to see me off, Lee Kelly. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, and Happy New Year to you. And yes. Let me say on behalf of all the listeners, Brian, how we will grieve your absence.
And I'll be grieving myself, I assure you. And Deb Bradfield.
Hi there, Brian, and Lee, and John.
And John Smith.
Hello there, Brian, and our listeners.
This is the whole crew together, yes.
Yep.
Our focus tonight is history. More about that shortly. But holiday reading. What have you been reading, Lee?
Well, I've just finished The Mandibles by Lionel Shriver, but I'm not allowed to talk about that because we're going to do a show.
Yes.
But I did receive some books I'd bought in the last few days, and I've just started one, which is a really interesting book that I got from Raphael Epstein on a rival book show.
I've heard him doing one.
He's very few listeners.
Good things just catch on, don't they?
Anyway, it's called East-West Street, On the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity.
Oh,
and it's basically a story, a sort of part memoir, part history about a village that has been fought over in various world wars. It was part Polish and then it was part of Germany and et cetera. Anyway, in this particular area, these two guys lived and also the author's grandfather. And he discovered, the author, Philippe Sands, because he's a lawyer, that his that village was where the two lawyers who prosecuted the Nuremberg trials post-World War II came from. And they were the guys that came up with the definition of crimes against humanity and genocide. Mm. So they sort of defined it as a result of their war experience. And his father came from that village as well. So he does this journey back, you know, sort of part discovery of his grandfather and part these guys and how their experience led him to this international stage at Nuremberg. So it's quite interesting. It's described as, I'll find it somewhere, a compelling family memoir intersects with the story of the Jewish legal minds who sowed the seeds for human rights at the Nuremberg trials. So I've just started
Sounds
that.
A bit heavy.
Yeah, it is quite heavy. But I think it's got
John's
enough.
Impressed.
I think because he's a lawyer, he's quite good linguistically. Mm. And so his writing style's quite clean, you know. So the material's heavy, but it's quite an easy read and he explains everything. So.
Yeah, not what I would have thought you'd have for holiday reading, but.
East-West Street.
Yeah, by Philippe Sands.
Mm. All right, what about you, Deb?
Yes, I've been reading Cutting for Stone by Abraham, Verghese.
Just give it to Brian.
Yes. I don't know, Brian, what do you think? Verghese or Verghese. But it's set in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, and I've never read anything set in Ethiopia before, so I'm finding it really interesting. And it's set in a mission hospital where two twins that were co-joined when they were born are raised. And it's the mother dies in childbirth and the father disappears because he just couldn't handle what had happened to the mother. And they're raised by two doctors, actually, at the mission. And the guy that wrote it is a doctor. And so all the medical stuff in it's quite graphic, but it's really interesting. You sort of feel like you could almost remove an appendix by the time you get past chapter two. But I'm loving it. So it's one of those ones that I know I'll be getting to the end and I'll be starting to drag my feet because I don't want it to finish. And that was what happened to my the friend that gave it to me, actually. So before this, he'd written two non-fiction. One about, he did a lot of work with AIDS patients somewhere in Tennessee, I think it was, and he wrote a memoir about that. So, Yeah, but well written, and it also got me interested then in Haile Selassie, but we can talk about that when this sort of dovetailing with the whole history, because it was set in about the 60s, so a very interesting book. I'd certainly recommend this one. So it's Cutting for Stone, Abraham Verghese.
So can I just ask a question? Does it deal with the, because they were conjoined, is it deal with the surgery that...
It seemed to be fairly minor. I think they might have just, it might have just been a skin attachment at the forehead. So, because they just did it in this mission hospital, they didn't go anywhere, you know, special to have it done. So it probably, I don't think it was a major operation.
So you could separate sides.
I feel quite confident.
Should we have any?
I'm confident about that now. So.
Cutting for Stone.
Yeah, great holiday read, that one.
And John, have you got any Christmas presents you're reading?
Yeah, totally different. I was given the Bruce Springsteen autobiography, Born to Run.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It is fantastic.
Is it?
It really is. I'm not a huge fan. I just don't read biographies, autobiographies. It took him 10 years to write, and it really gives you insights into how he's... I'm about two-thirds of the way through. And funny enough, just beautifully written. I love his songwriting, but that doesn't make him a good writer.
Some of
his prose is just beautiful. Really, really. It's just got me sucked in. I was reading it every night, nearly. And it's great.
What's his background?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
He grew up in a place in New Jersey. Very poor. His father was
New Jersey.
New Jersey on the shore. His father obviously had depression, but was an alcoholic, and so he was sort of shut out. His sister got pregnant at 17, eventually ran away and started a new life. Mother wouldn't leave him because he could never understand, you know, that. And left school, got his first guitar, and heard Elvis, actually, he reckons, on the radio, and it just something clicked. And just amazing sort of... He still sort of went back for his dad, but always felt guilty that his dad didn't love him, and he carried that. He could never attach himself to other people because he was never attached to his dad until he finally sort of met her, Patty, who... he's been married to for 25 years, and even then he'd married before but couldn't, and he found probably 40 years ago he suffered from depression and just thought he could handle it, you know, had all the success, was a bit of a control freak, but he's very aware of it. You know, it comes out in the book. He says, I know I'm a control freak, and all I had was the music, all he had was getting on stage. Once he was off stage, he couldn't deal with people so well. He was just always felt he was an outsider because of the way he was brought up. And he just writes about it fantastically, you know. And some of his friends still are just a local mechanic. You know, they go on motorbike rides.
Yeah.
You know, he grew up with these blokes. And he said it was a shithole he wanted to get out of, but it was always his home. He was always drawn back to this little one horse
town. You can see that in his songs, can't you?
Yeah.
In fact, we could have named songs if you told that story.
Like his third album, which made him really, was Born to Run. But it cost him that much. He virtually had to pay for it all himself. And that's why he started going on the road, because he said he had three albums and then manager, of course, and had no money. You know, he was a star. And then when he was on the front of Time and the Bulletin magazine in 77, and he said he was a very personal, and he couldn't handle the fame. He really struggled a lot with it, and it took him a long time. He was just into getting the best band he could, writing about these old, you know, he always wanted to write about his parents and where he come from, especially as a teenager. And as he evolved and got married and had kids, he started to write about that. But he writes fantastic. I was really surprised. I read the review when it came out last year in Rolling Stone, and they said it was beautifully written. And I suppose beautifully written is not the word for it, but I was just reading last night, and some of his prose about how he feels and, you know,
it's that sense
fantastic.
Of flow, isn't it? Like sometimes when you read those biographies, particularly, it can be really clunky.
Well, as you lent me the Peter Garrett biography there, and I found it interesting because I was a You're not ill. And I was just a fan of Peter Garrett's, but just hasn't got the turn of phrase that Springsteen has. I find it really fascinating to read. I mean, I don't know if other people would, but I don't usually like those genres. Very few of them are well written.
Yeah, some of them are almost impossible to read.
Yeah, but this is just fabulous. I'm really enjoying it, yeah.
I tried the Jennifer Saunders one and it was just horrible. About two chapters in or something, I thought, oh no, I just can't do it. So it's not like me. I usually persevere, but I couldn't with that one.
Especially if you paid for the book.
Yeah.
It's actually bad if it's borrowed.
It was a birthday present.
Oh, no, and you probably had to just read the cover and when they asked what it was like.
It's probably interesting, you know, the Bruce Springsteen one, like what you're saying is you enjoyed the story about his life and his struggles rather than the tale of his celebrity.
Yeah.
And Magda Savansky's Reckoning is very similar. Like, it's not really about who she knew in the industry or anything. Yeah, it's about her struggles with her weight and her father and her sexuality and all that sort of stuff. It's that. Yeah. It's more that insight into human problems rather than...
This is very much that, and his dealings with people and you know, he's obviously this in the struggle he's had with mental illness. And it took him a long time to sheet at home, and he didn't want to bring his kids up how he was. He could see that coming in his relationship. You know, he was getting like his dad when he was about 40, and he said, and luckily he was aware of it and he got help. But he said, even now, he's still dealing with, you know, like, you just have to, it doesn't go away, that sort of. But you wouldn't have known it, like, you know, as a fan. You know, you just listen to people's music, I suppose, and.
He always came across as a really decent sort of person, though. I thought, in you know, just little bits I've read about him, a real working class hero.
Yeah, and that's what he had trouble dealing with. And he also says this concept of, you know, was it Neil Young said, you know, rust never sleeps. You know, it's better to burn out and fade away. And he goes, what's the point of that? He said, all these rock and rollers who die at 27, there's a hell of a lot of music to be made and songs to be written.
And ironically,
don't give me this bullshit about dying early and becoming a bloody legend. He said, you know, I want to be still making music at 80. It's no good to me if I'm dead.
Yeah, and Neil Young's still alive.
Yeah, that's right. And he's in his 70s. Yeah. But it was an interesting, because a lot of his heroes were from the 50s. And Elvis and the Beatles, of course, because he was a little bit younger. But, you know, he said, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, he goes, I could never, and that's why he said he never got into drugs, or he didn't drink till he was about 25. And he said, I've just, you know, after a gig, a crew would go party and I just go home and eat me chicken and sit down, watch telly, because he said, my wife, he didn't want to die early. I thought, yeah, but it was a really good read. I'm really enjoying it.
Great.
You've reminded me, John, of what Lee Kaufman said at the Apollo Bay Writers Festival about good memoir and biography is an interrogation of a life. Rather than just a litany of, you know, and then we went to Headingley and I made another nice 50 runs, you know, which is so many books are actually.
Yeah.
Apparently Jimmy Barnes's book, Working Class Man, I think that's what it's called. That's
Working Class Hero, has to be called. Yeah.
Apparently that's quite interesting because he sort of interrogates that aspect of his life too, because his father was an alcoholic, I think, and really depressed
and
background.
Our subject tonight is history. Let's go back to English history, because I suppose most of our heritage comes from there. I've read, Lee, I'm sure you'd really enjoy this, Dan Jones, The Plantagenets. This book belongs to our mutual friend Dave Tardif, and it is a magnificent read.
Is it? This is like a historical novel or just a
history? No, it's a history.
It's
a history, yes. And but he tells, you know, it's like, you know, it's a gripping narrative, you know. It's got a few flashbacks in it. And, you know, he starts at the key juncture of the claim to the throne of England of the granddaughter of William the Conqueror. So after William, there was Henry, and Henry's heirs were drowned in the infamous White Ship mishap.
And I don't know that.
I haven't heard of that, that mishap.
And the difficulty for the people was that the only remaining heir was a woman.
Mm.
And people found that a bit tricky.
Mm.
Yes.
And in fact, the barons of England didn't acknowledge her claim to the throne, and it stalled, you know, a cousin, Stephen, as the third king of England. Matilda was having none of that, so she raised an army in France and stormed across the Channel and occupied the southwest of England for about 20 years. So there were rival monarchs in England for a long time. Mm. It was just a shambles, as so much of British history is.
Yeah.
Just a shambles. Eventually a compromise was reached where Matilda's son, Henry of Anjou, was declared the heir to the throne, and thus began the Plantagenet
reign.
Dynasty.
Dynasty, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would be Henry the Second?
Henry the Second, famous for the incident with Thomas a Becket.
Yes, now I've read about this.
In 1164, yes. But did he order the assassination or not?
Supposedly two knights overheard it and went and... But actually, on another note, Thomas a Becket.
Yes.
It's Thomas Becket.
Oh, that's right. Right.
But I think you should tell the story of really what happened.
Well, the interesting thing about Thomas Becket, you're right, John, is that in the mythology he's this saintly cleric, but he was anything but a saintly cleric.
There's a lot of that.
He had, for instance, he'd marched into Anjou at the head of an army. He was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. he was a powerful and unscrupulous man. And he was so much favoured by Henry II that Henry thought, well, he's the ideal man to appoint as Archbishop of Canterbury. He was ordained the day as a priest, not a bishop, a priest, the day before he was consecrated as Archbishop of Canterbury.
Shotgun wedding.
Get to the top real quick.
Boys. wonder how often this has happened in politics. Much to Henry's chagrin, Becket took the side of the church against the king, you know, on matters of taxes and appointments of bishops and this sort of thing, and became a champion of the church.
He obviously didn't realise he was in a puppet appointment.
No, he didn't. He didn't like the idea of being a puppet anyway. So, yes, as John says, the king was heard muttering about this... pestilent priest and some of his henchmen took matters into their own hands. In fact, they went into the cathedral. It's Canterbury, isn't it? Yeah. And they just threatened him and they withdrew. And then, I don't know, perhaps he sort of gave them
got out of hand.
Gave them the na-na. And they came storming back and cut his head off.
I read was worse than that. You know, they disemboweled him
very
or something.
Very nasty, yeah.
Well,
you know, that's another thing about English history. It has a grand tradition of thuggish...
Brutality,
yes. Really does.
I don't think it's just English somehow.
Oh, no. But...
Oh, you're sticking up for him.
But yeah, the thing is...
This has just gone on longer.
When I went to school, and I know none of you are as old as I am, but when I went to school, there was this mythology about how wonderful it all was. You know. And there is this thing in our study of history about, you know, the golden age, about how it used to be all so wonderful. Because it used to be abominable.
Yeah, especially if you were a peasant or a poor person. Shocking.
Yes. Anyway, Henry II's reign is noted for a number of things. The invasion of Ireland, and we've never forgiven the English for that, and that was, you know, that was in the 12th century. The institution of juries, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
and for the emergence of an obscure poet called Geoffrey Chaucer.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Who wrote considerable time after the death of Beckett. Well, actually, a lot long after. Long after, actually. No, it wasn't Henry II's reign, it was someone else's. Anyway, Henry's sons were famously Richard the Lionheart, who spent about 11 months of his life in England.
Yes, yes.
Robin Hood putting on the map.
I was going to say, the only thing I know about him was Robin Hood was looking after the rain while he was at the Crusades.
Hollywood's got a lot to answer for there.
Yeah.
And, of course, his nasty younger brother, John.
Oh, yeah, villain.
Who's best remembered for another another major milestone, that's Magna Carta.
Mm. Yes.
So that goes back to 1215.
So John wasn't as bad as Hollywood made up?
Oh, yeah, he was.
Oh, he was.
Yeah. He was a horror.
Was John. He?
Yeah.
Well, he only signed Magna Carta because the land...
Well, was it that or his head?
Yeah, they were going to take his head off.
Yeah. Mm. No, he was a horror. Mm. He was, cruel and vindictive and all those things. Anyway, I'm just going to try and pick out a few highlights here, Lee Kelly. It was the Parliament was apparently established in 1264 under the reign of Henry III, who came to the throne as a 9-year-old. But his reign was notable for the fact that he was actually controlled, by the barons, lots of civil war, and the famous Simon de Montfort established the Parliament.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's the first.
Oh, House of Commons, yeah?
Yes, yes, the House of Commons, and it was actually the next king, Edward I, who established the Lords and the Commons in 1295, yeah.
I was amazed to read at this time how English didn't become the official language, that French was the...
Yes.
I mean, I sort of knew that, but I thought, well, it's getting a bit late in the day for English to start making a run, isn't it?
Yeah, well, but didn't it do well?
It's picked up steam in the last few years.
Well, the interesting thing is that Henry V, famously of Agincourt, and once more unto the breach and all that sort of stuff... So you're talking the early 15th century. He was the first English monarch to speak English.
Mm.
Mm. Well, first, since the Norman Conquest.
Mm.
And the old Anglo-Saxon kings would spoke a language with which we would not be familiar.
It wasn't French either. It was something completely different.
No, it was Anglo. Mm. Old English,
It does put into perspective Chaucer's achievements.
Yes,
to have written something.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yes, so English. I was just reminded that the rise of the English language itself is pretty interesting, and it was largely an economic thing about trade. The French, the Normans, of course, brought French to England. And then for hundreds of years you had the old English of the peasants and the French of the upper classes. And so it took hundreds of years for them to merge.
Mm. Mm.
And it wasn't, I think, until the Reformation that English became the language of the law. And, you're talking 1530s.
Mm. Yeah. See, French has taken a battering, really, hasn't it? Like, we're talking about the rise of English. Because, when we were kids, we used to learn French at school, and Australian passports still have that translation of titles underneath in French.
Yes.
But, the French fight so aggressively to keep the language.
Yeah, they're very...
But they're losing.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of the problem, really, that English was able to diversify and take on from you know, a whole host of other languages, but French, they tried to keep it so pure that it sort of stagnated. I don't think the French would like to hear me say that. Any French listeners out there? But you know, it's a wonderful, it's a gorgeous language. But yes, the.
Don't people know we're on the radio? That's my telephone ringing.
Is that what it is? I was wondering what was going on.
I thought you were hearing music. The pearly gates.
My telephone's a mystery to me. I don't even know how to turn it off. The other thing about the rise of English, I suppose, was the printing press too.
Yes.
All right. So I've just been thumbing through my notes, trying to think of things that are important to us. Well, there's Magna Carta, there's Parliament, fairly durable institutions. Magna Carta's been invoked time and time again, because one of the characteristics of British history is a number of people have been deposed.
That person is determined to contact you, Brian. They might have something to say. They're probably French.
Probably French, yes.
Don't answer.
So a number of interesting, cases of, the king just being murdered, overthrown. Oh, dear.
Might be a stockbroker, Brian.
Sell.
Or my history tutor. I dare say there've been other important things. Oh, well, I mean, one of the other things that's still with us is Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries and...
creating of his own religion,
Well, the break with Rome.
But he's not considered in the Plantagenets.
No, he's the...
No, he's a lot
later.
I remember as a child being fascinated by the War of Roses.
Yes.
And that's not film with...
I know.
Those Hollywood stars.
Who was the last Plantagenet,
Was it Henry and Edward?
A kind of... matter of definition, but there were the Plantagenets go from Henry II in who sort of assumed the throne when was you're talking about two generations from William the Conqueror, and then the House of Lancaster. Richard II was murdered in the year 1400. And he was the last of the Plantagenets. And Henry IV, basically just murdered the king and took over, as they do in English history, quite a bit.
And then died of leprosy.
Or syphilis.
Henry IV,
yes.
Oh, God. You have been doing your homework. And Shakespeare wrote two plays about him, so I dare say he had a rich and varied life. So the House of Lancaster was Henry IV, 5th, 6th, another one who was deposed by the Duke of York.
That was the War of the Roses then?
Yes, the War of the Roses. And then the last of the Yorkist kings, there was the Duke of York, so that was Edward IV, Edward V, and Richard III.
Now, there's an interesting character.
And then Henry Richmond, or Henry Tudor, married Elizabeth of York and founded the Tudor dynasty.
Right.
And his son was Henry VIII.
And then things went dead quiet.
So but what about the author of this novel, Brian? Do you know? Has he a book? Has he written much?
Not a novel.
No, but he's an acclaimed historian. He's written about the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, and he's a columnist for the London Evening Standard, and he's a Cambridge Don.
Right.
Well, I find it I just find it really difficult to read straight history like that. Yeah, I admire you, Brian, that you can do it, and you love it.
It's a ripping yarn.
Yeah, and I have a friend who's the same, and he's read everything on Stalin that you could that's been written. Well, and that
I mean, that's a bit dry.
He's got a taste for gore.
He has. Brian's waving something else at me now.
Looks like a 19th century Bible.
Maybe a dictionary.
Yeah, I really like to get my history, in a novel form. And that
I do.
And then that spurs me on to look up other things. So I've got very interested in Haile Selassie now because of reading this Cutting for Stone book. So now I've started investigating him. And I could tell you quite a bit about Haile Selassie now, which I could not have done yesterday. So that's why I sort of use it as a springboard, but to find out what I am interested in. But I just couldn't. It's just too dry for me. I just can't. I'm not something enough. I'm not quite sure what it is.
My point was that there are enduring legacies. There's, as we said, Magna Carta, Parliament, the Reformation, and of course the sectarian history of Australia's very, very vital to our own history. Excuse me. And then there's the whole Stuart Jacobin thing and the overthrow of James II in 1688 and the orange and the green and all that sort of stuff, which is still a vital part of our history. And it's the supremacy of Parliament over the monarchy dates from, you know, 1689.
I think that's really interesting because the Americans, look out if there's Americans out there, will be in trouble too.
Another phone call.
Alienating everybody.
they sort of assume the mantle of the birth of democracy, don't they? Like, those ideals and et cetera. Yeah. Whereas the English system, which was far longer in its germination, has actually provided quite a stable arrangement, particularly when you look at what American democracy has thrown up recently.
That's right. It would never happen in England.
You know, it seemed like a bizarre system.
Or would it? Yeah.
Well, there was Brexit.
We hope not.
But that they have been the home of that sort of long birth of parliamentary system and democracy.
Ironically, for those of us brought up as Roman Catholics, the irony of it is that the stability of British democracy was founded on an anti-Catholic principle. You know, with the expulsion of, the Stuarts in 1688. And in 1703, that Act of Settlement, which I think was only revoked last year, wasn't it? And that is that no heir to the throne may marry a Catholic. No Catholic may assume the throne of England. And that was in place for 400 years.
Going there. Given the
Catholic. Oh, now we've got the Catholics against us. That leaves our audience
I think they're onto something.
Yeah, we've only got Rusty left. French, American, nor Catholic.
What do we do? Have a go at Silas just to put him offside?
Could do.
Yes.
Well, I might leave it.
I don't want to offend any of our Catholic listeners out there. Sorry.
Well, I do, Deb, despite your reservations, I highly recommend it. The Plantagenets by Dan Jones. A ripping yarn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I just had one question for Brian, and that was about Edward II. That was he killed or was he spirited away? Because there seems to be some arising now, some sort of controversy about whether he was in fact killed.
Well, Edward II died in 1327, but he was one of those ones who famously never lived up to his father's reputation. Edward I was the hammer of the Scots and all that sort of thing, you know.
And hard man.
Conquered Wales and Scotland. Edward II struggled his whole life. He wasn't interested really in being a soldier. And apparently neglected his wife and spent an inordinate amount of time with a French gentleman called Piers Gaveston.
This is a family show, Brian.
So the story goes that, well, his wife famously took a lover and raised an army against him.
Oh, yes. Oh. I heard this bit.
He was incarcerated, and so the story goes, he died a gruesome death.
Well, he does sound interesting. Someone make a movie on him.
Yes. Well, I told you it was an interesting book.
Yes, but I still don't think I'll read it, Brian. I'm sorry.
Well, whether he was spirited away or not, but, you know, there are myths about his death. Mm. A gruesome death, apparently.
Right.
Mm. Possibly at the inspiration of his wife.
Mm.
Who had her revenge.
But wife and husband meant different things in those times, didn't they?
Oh, they did.
They're more about who you brought with you and what lands and
their dowries and alliances, political alliances and all that. Yes.
Yes, might still be similar today, actually. No, we didn't mean that as a joke.
No. All right. So there we are, the enduring legacy of the British monarchy, and we're joined by Mary Lou Gardam, all the way from Hay in New South Wales. Hello, Lou.
Hello, bro.
And it's lovely to have you on Apollo Bay Radio's book show. And you are a teacher of history.
Yes.
And in a school in Hay.
In Hay, yes, yeah. Hay War Memorial High School. So we have a strong focus on World War One. A small school, probably similar in size to Apollo Bay, I suspect. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure it's a bit warmer up there than it is
39 here. This week.
Is it?
Yes. A little bit drier too, I should imagine.
We're expecting summer any week now.
So next week, I think.
Lou's teaching Richard III this year, so haven't said anything about that mystery. We used to do that at school. They had a history mystery box about what happened to the princes in the tower, you know. Yes. I like that.
Yes. Yeah, but then now the history mystery goes to the Leicester car park.
That's right. Modern science has taken all the mystery out of it. They've x-rayed him and goodness knows what, and found out what his problem was. And but they still don't know. They still don't know what happened to the princes, do they? They haven't found those bodies. Do you know this story?
No, I don't. Yeah.
Well,
no.
I don't know it all that well, so I don't know.
Go on, Lee.
But he sort of usurped the throne, didn't he? There was one of the princes who was the rightful...
who was, in fact, Edward V, he was about 10 years old or something, and was king for a week or two until he mysteriously disappeared.
And the theory was that they'd been walled up.
In the Tower of London.
Yeah.
He and his little brother.
But they didn't have CSI in those days, so they couldn't prove anything, so... Mm.
And they weren't prepared to pull the tower apart.
They would now, I'm sure. But he was always a bit of a vexed figure because no one really knew whether Richard was evil or, innocent.
Well, the circumstantial evidence against him is fairly strong because, Edward IV was a notoriously murderous King of England, and he had those two young boys who were his heirs. When he died, he had these young heirs, and they were on their way from Wales or somewhere to London, you know, to assume their rightful place, heir to the throne and spare, and they were intercepted by their uncle, Richard III, and for safekeeping, for their own good, they were ensconced in the Tower of London, from which they never emerged.
Oh, wow.
And Richard was proclaimed king some weeks later. So the circumstantial evidence is not all that favourable, but I don't know, would a jury convict him? But this was a particularly violent time in British history. I mean, murders left, right and centre. Mm. You know, the previous king, Edward IV, had his brother murdered. You know, they were horrible people. Yeah. Horrible. And, of course, the Tudors were not much better. I mean, Henry VIII, we should all know this, but I don't. Divorced, beheaded his six wives. What were they? Divorced, beheaded.
You should know it.
Yeah.
Yes.
One
died in childbirth.
Yeah, one died in childbirth.
Died in childbirth. That was the mother of the boy king. Then divorced Anne of Cleves, beheaded Catherine Howard, and was survived by Catherine Parr.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there were violent times. And then, of course, his daughter, Bloody Mary, was responsible for thousands of executions.
But it's interesting, you know, you talk about it like as if, you know, murdering your brother. I'm not saying that was a good thing. It's not a good thing. But the concept of siblings is something that we have rather than necessarily the royal families of that time would have even known. You know, they were often brought up strangers to one another, like it was a blood relationship rather than a familial sort of one. Nonetheless, says something about a character.
Yes, and I'm sure they convinced themselves it was all for the better, for the general good too, you know.
Power.
Yeah.
Oh. And then Shakespeare came along and was sanitising the Tudors for his audience.
So. Yes. Yeah. So I haven't read Richard III. What is the portrayal of him like?
He's the House of York, not the... he's bad
he's
guy.
Diabolical. Diabolical. But a fascinating character.
Mm.
One of Shakespeare's more interesting characters. And here's a little kind of paradox that, you know, good people aren't often very interesting, are they?
No, that's right. They're evil cells.
Yeah. All right. So have we exhausted the kings and queens of England?
Well, you've certainly shown us that there's interesting things in the Plantagenets, Brian, but whether or not I'm with you, I don't know if I could get through it.
Just no, especially as we've got so many other things that we have to read that we keep introducing each other to.
Like I've got this one.
That's right, this one.
Oh, sorry, but they can't see that. Cutting for Stone, the one I mentioned earlier.
And this one, I do recommend this one. This is Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Harari.
Brief History of Humankind.
Yes.
Takes on a big subject. Oh,
it's wonderful. Have you read it, Deb?
No, but I'm going to because I looked it up earlier today.
Do you want to take it?
I will. I'll take it right now.
They're physically swapping books now.
Because it really appealed to me, this...
Maybe I can. The whole history of humankind in 500 pages.
So what's, tell us about it, Brian.
Well, I don't know how far back he goes, like millions of years, but he basically says, look, the history of our kind is kind of divided into about, say, half a dozen epochs. There's the, you know, when Neanderthals were still around, and he says, and these people were humans too, but Homo sapiens emerged as the dominant, whatever, genus, I suppose. But
there were six different groups.
Yes, yes.
Not just the Neanderthals, that was something I read today when I was looking this up.
Yes. And so the first thing was I think the cognitive revolution, wasn't it?
That's first in this book.
Perhaps because of diet or whatever, but Homo sapiens developed this intellectual capacity which then allowed Homo sapiens to dominate and basically murder the rest of them. So, you know, we are the heirs of the murderers.
So we can't poke at the English, can we?
No.
We're all stained.
Yeah.
But we do have a lot of Neanderthal DNA.
Well, when you say a lot, about 2%.
Well, we do have. So, and redheads have the most.
Do they?
They
That's
do.
The Vikings.
Oh, is it?
Look out.
Yes. So I found that also very readable. I'll be interested to know whether you find it readable, Deb. But
yes.
So the and then so the next one he says is after the cognitive revolution, when Homo sapiens developed this superior brain power, is the agricultural revolution, where the hunter-gatherer lifestyle was gradually dominated by people who divided their labour. Some people grew the crops, some people tallied the crops.
That's always been a distinction that's been in history, though, hasn't it? The idea of being able to produce, specialise and grow things, not everything you need, but just is a mark of a civilisation.
Yes. But in fact, I think he's quite negative about the agricultural revolution. I haven't read it yet, but that was one of the things that really interested me when I was reading about it, that he sees it as one giant sort of fraud, really, on the human race. So I'll be very interested to read about that.
Yeah. So the where power is grabbed by certain people who then employ the masses to produce their food, and they swan about writing books and
killing their brothers,
and radio programs. And they develop these upper classes. I think that's his main point. Then they have a military class, and that leads to all sorts of problems. Then there's a bit of a jump, and until about the year 1500, and he actually nominates the year 1500, within a few years, as a major turning point. And he actually associates it with Vasco da Gama. And whereas people talk about the printing press and the scientific revolution and, the Renaissance and the emerging enlightenment and all that stuff. And he says, yes, but don't forget it was the Portuguese whose attitude changed. And that is they went off exploring.
Mm.
And that was a fundamental change.
Mm. Does he mention anything about the Chinese exploring?
Yes, I think he does.
Mm.
I think he does.
Because I think they might have been exploring prior to Vasco da Gama.
Yes. And then there was a policy change in China.
That's right, yes. Mm.
But anyway, so this the sort of modern world dates, I suppose, from about 1500 when this attitude to knowledge change, which previously it had been a scholastic attitude where the more educated you were, the more you knew about Aristotle and the Roman poets and so on, whereas from about 1500, the more educated you were, the more you contributed to new knowledge.
Mm.
And that's been a fundamental shift. And then, 1700, the Industrial Revolution, from which we are just really emerging, I suppose, in the last 50 years or so.
So what's his take on it? Is he approaching it as a sort of like a biologist, or is he approaching it more as a sort of sociologist or something? I don't know. Is he looking at the physical changes in humans, or is he looking at the attitudinal?
Yeah, I think it's attitudinal, but I've just forgotten if I did know, Deb. What's his discipline? Is it sociology?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't read that bit. But, PhD in history from the University of Oxford. Specialises in world history. His research focuses on broad questions such as what is the relation between history and biology? Is there justice in history? Did people become happier as history unfolded? And I think there's something in here about him thinking that actually we would have been better off staying in the Stone Age, that we were much happier then than now, which was another thing that really piqued my interest.
And I think contemporary events might substantiate this point that really, we seem to have entered a new dark age, don't we?
Well, does he talk about the technological revolution as the next phase?
Yes.
Yes, I think he does.
Yes. Yeah, but I don't know if he makes the point, but it's an obvious one to make, that we live in the information age where more and more of us are misinformed.
Yeah, actually, not wanting to foreshadow or discuss Lionel Shriver, but her book, The Mandibles, is a sort of dystopian, you know, world, future world. But anyway, in it, they've had a period where the internet drops out, and they call it the Stone Age because all the cars stop in the streets and nothing will work, and sort of like.
What they thought would happen in the year 2000.
Yes, the 2K wireback.
Yeah.
Well, Lionel Shriver, she was in the news last year, wasn't she? Because she spoke about identity politics.
Yes, no, she's controversial.
Well, I'm going to quickly read one of hers. I've got to order it from the library for next month, I think.
Yeah. Right. Next month.
Yes, well, and Brian might be. Well, I think that's what we. Lee and I were sort of. Floated that idea. We hadn't firmed up on anything. But. And we're hoping that Brian, our listeners here, we've got a new desk in here. And as you know, Brian is leaving us, which we're very, very, very unhappy about. But. He will be calling in from Ballarat, so hopefully we'll all be able to figure out how to patch him in, and he will still be part of our discussions, which will be wonderful.
It's going in my diary. First Tuesday in February, and we're talking about Lionel
Shriver.
Yeah, yep.
Must make
an American note. Also, what have you been reading?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it's been fun. It's been fun with this.
Don't go, Brian. Don't sign off, Brian.
Well,
no one can take that chair.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such fun. And it ain't over till it's over. As the New York catcher Yogi Berra famously said. He was the man whose school teacher said to him, "Yogi Berra, don't you know anything?" And he said, "Sir, I don't even suspect anything." Famous not so much for his wit as for his prowess on the baseball field. Oh. Yogi Berra, you'd remember Yogi Bear.
Yogi Bear. I can't remember much
named
about
after
him.
A real person.
Oh, was he?
No, Yogi Bear the cartoon.
Yes.
Named
yes.
after Yogi Bear.
Ah.
The baseball
player. It's a bit dumb, Yogi Bear. He was always doing
a baseballer.
And weren't there some chocolates or something? Wasn't there a Yogi Bear chocolate?
Yes, there was. There was.
Yeah. I remember that. I was more interested in the chocolate.
All right. More of the book show in a month's time. And Lee Kelly, Deb Bradfield will be with you then, perhaps John Smith, and certainly at a later time. Thank you for coming in, Mary Lou.
Thank you.
All the way from Hay for a few minutes on the radio. Commendable effort.
And we'll catch you all soon.
Bye-bye, Brian.
Bye.